Can Europeans and Americans still speak of shared values? The longest ever speech by a U.S. president to a joint session of Congress, doubling down on an America First vision of foreign policy that's heavy on the sticks and light on the carrots. In the past, critics of the U.S. would dismiss talk of exporting democracy by pointing to places like Vietnam, Latin America, Iraq, saying the velvet glove the United States had was also using an iron fist. But the United States also putting its might behind international institutions for brokering peace and norms that do business the world over. Norms the world could trust. Globalization without a U.S. backstop has consequences. Has the U.S. become a nationalist, illiberal democracy? Or does it all just return to normal when next year's midterm elections roll around? Ukraine can't wait that long. Europe finds itself having to rewrite its entire security architecture on the fly. Here you see Emmanuel Macron, who later will be dining with Viktor Orban, one of Donald Trump's only kindred spirits on this continent, this ahead of an EU summit that's staring at the sudden end of the post-1945 order. Why did allies not see this moment coming? Today in the France 24 debate, we're asking, is it the end of shared values across the Atlantic Ocean? How much America has changed since we spoke with pastor and theologian Amy Butler in Washington for Joe Biden's inauguration 4 years ago. Reverend Butler, thank you for joining us outside of the Beltway, way outside in Honolulu, Hawaii.
Yes. Hello. It's great to see you again.
We're joined from London by historian and political scientist Jeffrey Cabot-Service, director of political studies at the Niskanen Center think tank. Welcome to the show.
Good to be here with you.
Davina Frau-Meggs is professor emerita at Sorbonne Nouvelle University. Welcome back.
Good evening.
You can, by the way, listen, like, and subscribe to the France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. He had the floor for a record 99 minutes. Donald Trump crawling before a divided joint session of Congress. Matthew Mary Carouchet has the story.
President Donald Trump on Tuesday gave his first address to Congress since returning to power in a speech peppered with his usual flair for dramatic exaggeration and raucous remarks. But in a marked change from their usual predilection for passive decorum, his forcefulness was matched by some Democratic lawmakers, including Al Green, who was evicted after heckling the president over proposed cuts to a health insurance program.
It is the best way to get it across to a person who uses his incivility, against our civility.
The speech comes after Trump's sweeping new tariffs against Mexico, Canada, and China drove U.S. markets down for a second straight day. Nonetheless, he doubled down, promising to continue increasing tariffs against the U.S.'s major trading partners to protect domestic producers.
Tariffs are about making America rich again and making America great again, and it's happening, and it will happen rather quickly. There'll be a little disturbance, but we're okay with that.
The rest of his speech ran the gamut from lauding the plunge in illegal crossings of the U.S.-Mexico border to withdrawing from the World Health Organization and the Paris Climate Agreement. But Trump dedicated a significant portion of his speech to touting his war on diversity programs, which have led to the dismantling of discrimination protections. Even though he lambasted unelected bureaucrats, Trump praised his own in the form of Elon Musk, who runs the Department of Government Efficiency. Trump said DOGE had reduced the national debt after cutting hundreds of billions of dollars of so-called government fraud, which no independent fact-checkers have been able to verify. Turning to the war in Ukraine, Trump said he was pleased at Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's renewed desire to return to the bargaining table.
Simultaneously, we've had serious discussions with Russia and have received strong signals that they are ready for peace. Wouldn't that be beautiful? Wouldn't that be beautiful?
During his speech, Trump complained that some Democrats were not applauding. In fact, many of them walked out in the middle of it.
Jeffrey Cabot-Service, being an American in London and watching all of this, what's your feeling?
Uh, I feel that we're at the end of an era, and it's not a happy feeling. At best, I can muster up a whistling past the graveyard kind of feeling. You know, the first book I wrote was a study of great American leaders who consciously looked to the UK for their example, who had seen America triumph in World War II, who understood that the previous generation before them had created a durable, global American-led order that could actually put an end to the endless fighting and conflict and destruction and annihilation that Europe in particular had experienced just in the first decades of the 20th century. You know, the book I was consciously imitating was called The Wise Men. My book was called The Guardians. You could write a book about the current leaders right now in America called The Squanderers. And I'm afraid that we will look back to this period as one when America squandered the advantages that better leaders had striven so consistently and difficult and under difficult circumstances to build over the previous 80 years.
Is it squandering or is it ideology? What's driving what's driving this change in the United States that we heard on display in that speech?
Donald Trump's speech was a sort of campaign rally speech full of the usual gloating and rhetoric, full of vague promises that he has no plans for achieving and not really any idea of how to go about achieving them. It was essentially just the usual sort of thing that you would expect candidate Trump to give, not President Trump. And if anything, it really gave an indication that his major goal for this second administration is retribution rather than making America great again in any meaningful way.
Retribution. Reverend Butler, let me ask you, we saw at the outset of that report that Democratic congressman who stood up and was eventually escorted out of the House of Representatives chamber there. He said he had to do it because of the incivility of the U.S. president. Was it justified, that act?
Well, I'm here, of course, not as a policy analyst, but as a pastor and a religious leader here on, ironically, Ash Wednesday, where the Western Church remembers a time when political power and fear were the all-encompassing parts of our religious story. What I can tell you is that it is the government's responsibility to care for the moral fabric of our society, to weave and to help us build a society that cares for our neighbors. And it is our obligation to speak out against any kind of suffering that we see. And so, I agree. And I would have been there with him.
This notion of concentric circles of Christian values as espoused by the U.S. vice president. What's your reaction?
I do not agree with most of my neighbors who call themselves Christians and have voted in this way. But I do want to warn us in this moment that our work is to understand each other rather than to demonize each other, because I think very quickly, again, I'm not a policy analyst, I am a religious leader, but the moment we begin dehumanizing each other, we begin down a path that is extremely, extremely dangerous and evil.
All right. With so many Americans only getting their news from outlets that reinforce their own beliefs, there was this moment when Donald Trump walked in, New Mexico Democratic Congresswoman Melanie Stansbury displaying a discreet sign that's saying this is not normal. And the sign is for all to see. When the president passed, the sign was ripped away. You saw the moment fleetingly. Maybe we could show it again a second time. Ripped away by Texas Republican Lance Gooden. She's holding that sign. It says, "This is not normal." There you see the cutaway. And up, he rips it away, the sign. Gooden, who later tweeted, "No one will disrespect President Trump in front of me." Davina Frommeggs, what happens in the State of the Union addresses, the boos, the cheers, the interruptions? It's just a bit of political theater. You heard earlier Jeffrey talking about how this was more like a campaign speech. We're making too much of these performance politics?
it's hard to express what is going on. To me, taking it less as a political speech, political communication, than a very personal communication from Trump, taken from his TV experience. And what I see is the show of a bully. And with all the apparatus of bullying around it. And I'm a specialist of bullying online. And I'm seeing the politics of fear coming back, the politics of silencing people, especially women, the extracts you showed, showing off to the rest of the world that this is now the end of soft power, as traditionally values of human rights have been extolled, and the end of that, and the announcement of hard power for the rest of the world to see. So, from the perspective of civil society, where I have been as a member of NGOs and NGOs that are part of the UN, we have seen this coming in the US. The US has not ratified. It didn't ratify the women's treaties. It didn't ratify disabilities treaties, rights of the child treaties, high seas treaties, climate change. So the US have been shifting for a while. We have not wanted to see it from the outside because we still think of them as champions of human rights. But that was as long as human rights were useful for them. What we're seeing is a return of the utilitarianism of very early America, which puts self-interest first. And then that means isolationism, so also the self-interest of America first, this patriotism. And it advances using religion, I would say almost weaponizing religions against the believers themselves with these different circles, as you were mentioning. The first circle
saying
is
saying,
I
love my family.
I love myself. Then it's my family. You see how shrunk that is. Then it's maybe my community, as long as my community agrees with me, otherwise they're expelled. And maybe then my nation, certainly not the rest of the world. And he's shown it is in his despise of other regimes, England, whatever. So yes, there is a big shift, visibly, ostentatiously, willfully, to instill fear and mesmerize us. And what is happening to us, of course, when a bully arrives, it makes the whole field around them toxic, and it makes our whole brain only concentrate on that, not thinking of other solutions, alternatives, ways to react.
Why is it more polarized than before? It's even more polarized than it was during the first Trump administration. It feels like that 6 weeks in.
Right. Well, because they have learned from their first experience and they've taken all the precautions. And now they actually have all the different instances of power in the United States, which, of course, causes mistrust in people like me who used to think, OK, there's going to be among the values of the United States, there is this balance of powers. And this balance of powers is totally unbalanced right now. It's all in the hands of one person and the bullies around him. These bullies are shown. He's never alone. A bully is never alone. The victim is always alone. You've seen Zelensky alone, all the bullies around. And so the scenography of that is very clear, and it's sent to the friends as well as the enemies. Is we are going to wield power the way we want, and you know what? We can.
Mm.
And we are all men.
Let's go to Los Angeles. Republican strategist Matt Klink joins our conversation. Thank you so much for being with us here in the France 24 debate. The return of a utilitarian America, one that puts the individual first. Do you agree that's what we're witnessing?
Wow. I mean, there's a lot of unpack in what I just heard. You know, let's start at the forefront of looking at the Donald Trump cabinet. You have a female attorney general. You have a female who is going to be the United States ambassador to the UN. You have a female who is the director of national intelligence. You have a gay secretary of the treasurer. So, again, I think that what you just heard is a Euro-focused perspective on what America is or what they believe it to be. It does not reflect reality. I will tell you that Donald Trump's speech last night, well, long from the domestic consumption perspective, went over extremely well. I would remind the previous guest that Donald Trump had both houses of Congress when he took the reins of power in 2017. Joe Biden and the Democrats had both houses of power when he took the reins in 2021. And Donald Trump now has both houses and the presidency in 2025. The difference being is that when Joe Biden was elected, we had a low energy president who, and this is why Donald Trump won. Not only did he win the Electoral College, which is what matters in America, he won the popular vote. He won a greater vote share among young people, among blacks, and among Latinos. And he won 89% of all counties in 2025. He had a higher vote total
Matt Klink,
than he did in 2020.
Can you reassure Davina Frau Meggs, who was wondering about what the rest of the world admires the system of checks and balances you have in the United States? Can you reassure her that that's not being undermined or gutted by what's going on right now? We've heard
we've seen a
record number of
exactly
executive
that.
Orders.
Sure. Just as Franklin Roosevelt did in 1933 when he took office. And I think that, for Donald Trump to pass his, I mean, right now this is kind of, it's still mostly a Joe Biden economy because Donald Trump needs Congress, and he's going to do it through a process called reconciliation, where he won't need any Democratic votes to do it, to pass his economic agenda. That's what Joe Biden did in 2021. That's what the first Trump tax extensions were. We still have checks and balance in the United States. We still have three independent branches of government. The previous speaker just doesn't like it that the Republicans control two of three branches of government right now. The pendulum will swing back again if the Republicans overreach.
Jeffrey Cabot-Service, the pendulum will swing. We're 6 weeks in, but we just have to wait for the midterms to see what the voters decide.
Well, that's a good question, because I do think that what Donald Trump is trying to do is different from what other presidents have done almost through the entirety of United States history. It's true, for example, that Joe Biden had a majority of Democrats in Congress when he took office in 2021, and he did pass his Inflation Reduction Act, which was his major climate program, through reconciliation, which did not require any Republican votes. But it's also true that Biden passed a number of bipartisan bills with significant Republican assistance, including the CHIPS and Science Act and the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act. Trump could go through Congress to achieve much of what he wants. He could actually have Congress propose a law to abolish USAID, for example, and get rid of American foreign aid. But he doesn't want to do that because he doesn't, frankly, want to go through Congress. He doesn't want to mess with such things. He wants to assert strong leadership in his own way. And it's really to be determined if he's going to abide by any of the court orders that have forbidden him from some of the actions he's already carried out in terms of withholding foreign aid, going against the expressed wish of Congress, and refusing to allow, really to abide by constitutional limits.
Reverend Butler, how do you explain this sudden closure of the United States' international aid agency, one which is a major contributor in a lot of the countries where we're viewed, and a major contributor to a lot of UN organizations?
Again, I'm not here as a policy analyst. I'm here as a religious leader. And so I would have to say that this is the surrendering of moral leadership in the world. And I think the U.S. has slipped into a place where we are condoning violence on many different levels on our borders and also around the world. And certainly by stopping this aid, we are creating suffering for so many people. And that's what we need to remember. This goes beyond history and policy and any kind of analyzing to the lives of real, real people. And I hear the words of the professor, and I'd like to point out that in the chamber last night, it was largely white, and it was extremely divided. So this story of America is all together, and we're all going to be strong again, is not true. We are afraid, and our work in this moment is to not give in to that fear and to care for our neighbors in a way that eliminates that suffering.
I really have to correct the fact, because fact-checking is becoming more and more important. There is the Supreme Court, and that's the third power that has been captured by the Republicans and the Trump Republicans. So it's a total imbalance and a total capture of power. It's not even going through Congress. Congress has been neutralized, and even when Congress protests, as we've seen...
But those are the rules. That's just the way the democracy is. The Supreme Court justices are appointed for life, and so
yes,
be it.
For sure. And usually they are balanced. In this case, they are totally on the side of Trump. And every time there is a legal case that comes up, it ends up with them, and it's denied. We've seen it with even what was going on about Trump himself, who's now suddenly totally free of all the crimes he's been charged with. So I think we have a different situation from before. There's a concentration on power in one man who is short-circuiting even the other elements, as we were saying. He's not even going for Congress. All these executive orders are doing that, putting DOGE inside his own executive office prevents any transparency about what is going on among some of the biggest changes that are being done at the federal level.
Matt Klink, that's perhaps what kind of shocks in terms of values Europeans the most, that Elon Musk, who expresses apartheid-era nostalgia in South Africa, who retweets far-right activists in Europe against the sitting leaders of the countries here, has so much power. How do you explain this?
Well, let's be very clear. You can judge Elon by his words. He acknowledges that Donald Trump is the president and is the leader. Elon Musk is a tool that is being used by the Trump administration to do what needs to be done in terms of getting rid of government bureaucracy. And frankly, you know, look, the United States is the most generous nation in the history of the world, and it will continue to be. We're just not going to be foolish with aid. And if you listen to Trump's speech last night, he spent a good 4 or 5 minutes listing some of the ridiculous things the U.S. government has spent money on. That is overwhelmingly popular with the American electorate. And I will tell you, to the point of, you know, that in terms of racial composition, Donald Trump did better with minority voters, with married women voters, and with young voters of all stripes than a Republican has in a long time. So, look, the reality is that the globalist status quo that has existed for a long time, Americans have seen our quality of life eroded, where we send massive transfer payments overseas and we get nothing in return. And I think that and people say, well, now you're weakening NATO. I would remind everybody in Europe, the U.S. has over 60,000 troops, boots on the ground right now. That demonstrates our commitment to Europe. So Europe needs to step up. If Europe wants to do more for Ukraine, then they should. But the truth is that Europe spends more on oil and natural gas to Russia than it does on aid to Ukraine. So let's end the hypocrisy there. If Europe wants to step up, they should. But America is not going to be.
But when a U.S. president negotiates, all right. But when a U.S. president negotiates directly with the Russian president without consulting allies,
Talk to the Russian. Joe Biden didn't talk to the Russian president for 4 years. We've given over $200 billion to Ukraine, and they're not winning.
But there were no Russia specialists in the room when they sat down in Riyadh. Well, let's take a listen, if you will, to Canada's prime minister. He was talking on Tuesday about the 25% tariffs on his country. Justin Trudeau appealing directly to the American people in asking them to choose neighbors and allies over Russia.
I think the question that we all need to be watching closely is, what do the American people think? How do Americans feel about jettisoning one's friends and allies in favor of a country that has never wished Americans well and continues to act in ways that harm the global economy and specifically the American economy and American values and principles.
So let's go around the room on this, because this is an important notion that we need to nail down. Amy Butler, what to you signifies American values? What are American values?
Well, it's interesting. There are different ways to wield power. There's soft power and there's hard power. And I think that Donald Trump has now taken us into a world where we have embraced a perception around the world that we are unwilling to be good neighbors. And that's a very, very scary place to be. That said, the world knows, you know better than we do, that we have been in these places before, and that I don't want to diminish the fear of this moment of where we are, but I feel that we can move to a better place if Americans are willing to set aside the fear and to do the work of caring for our neighbors, as the Prime Minister said.
Matt Klink, was that a convincing argument you heard from Prime Minister Trudeau?
Dr. Prime Minister in Canada.
Sorry, can you repeat that? Missed the beginning of that. Go ahead again, Matt Klink.
I apologize. Yeah, I mean, look, from a lame duck Canadian prime minister who has zero residence in the United States of America, people don't care what he has to say. Canada needs the U.S. more than the U.S. needs Canada. All that being said, what Donald Trump won in November on was America has lost focus. We lost track of the fact that America needs to take care of its own citizens first, and that we will still be a good neighbor, but we have to look after America first. We have a $36 trillion budget deficit. We still have troops all over the world that nobody is talking about pulling them back, and we will maintain our commitments, but soft power does not work. America will be there when allies need us. Donald Trump just doesn't want to have to throw $200 billion into Ukraine with no end in sight and no potential chance for victory. That's why he wants to end that conflict and hopefully move on to something more productive.
Jeffrey Cabot-Service, do you agree? Soft power does not work. And what is your view of American values?
You know, you'll get different answers about what America's values are from different Americans. And my views, which are very much rooted in being an American historian, are that America has believed in freedom and democracy. And we have supported that overseas because we believe that the more there is democracy in the world, the more peaceful and prosperous the world will be. Ever since 1945, we have safeguarded a world in which tariffs get lower, trade gets freer, and we had tried to help citizens around the world achieve the benefits of this global world order with great success. We brought billions of people out of poverty around what used to be known as the Third World. And we kept the peace after the destructive first half of the 21st century, in which millions and millions of people died and genocide blackened the face of the earth. To throw all that away now just seems to me the peak of futility and foolishness. Donald Trump doesn't believe in this American-led global order. He wants to go back to the world of great powers of the 19th century, where the strong do what they will and the weak suffer what they must. He believes in great powers. He thinks Russia's a great power. China is too, maybe even Turkey. They should all have their spheres where they determine what goes on, and they should respect each other's boundaries. That's just a world in which we will have de-civilizational consequences.
And this view of the world... you heard earlier in the conversation, Davina Frau-Meggs hark back to the early days when the United States was founded. But how far back does it go? Does it go back to Ronald Reagan saying the government's are part of the problem, not the solution? Does it go back even further? Where does this go? From where does this come, this utilitarian notion, I'm borrowing Davina's line, of the world?
the English.
I mean, America's always had different ideas about how to approach the world. If you go back to George Washington, he warned us against entangling alliances, particularly with old Europe. He wanted America to be separate from those old ancestral hatreds. But the fact is that the world has changed largely because of America's actions. And America goes back and forth in believing whether it's worthwhile to support that global order, because it's true. We haven't squeezed all of our partners to the extent we could if we actually wanted to maximize our economic advantage. But we've also believed that that American-led global order is very good for us in many ways, certainly economic, not least because we get to use our own currency as the world's reserve currency, but also in other ways, by the fact that we don't actually have to fight wars and kind of global conflagrations, by the fact that we're able to share intelligence with our allies, by the fact that goods are able to pass back and forth over borders to be serviced at the lowest possible cost to the consumer. All of that is going to go away if we believe that soft power doesn't matter and our alliances, if we continue to treat them as Trump has, as our enemies, while he treats our enemies as our maybe friends.
Well, Donald Trump, perhaps correct, at least in the short run, on one point, which is this sort of a might is right moment in that speech. Hong Kong's C.K. Hutchinson announcing it was selling the operating concession of the Panama Canal to a consortium backed by Wall Street fund BlackRock. That was enough for Trump to tell Congress in his speech that the U.S. had taken back the canal, which it gave up in 1999. Of course, the president of Panama sees it differently. Once again, President Trump is lying. The Panama Canal is not in the process of being handed back. However, Davina Fraumeggs, this Hong Kong consortium did sell to a U.S. company.
What I see is what's happening to the American people, and we have a perfect example. He is talking to his base and, as usual, lying, because, as you said, Panama is still part of Panama. Probably lying about the fact that probably there are deals around there with China. He also dropped the SHIFT project with Taiwan, which doesn't harm, is not good, a good announcement for Taiwan. So are there deals under the deals that will appear only later? I think the fact that he occupies the space also prevents us from looking at what is in the shadows. That's what bullies do very well. But I think for the American people who voted for him, they are victims of the social media and this free speech, the fake free speech of the social media, which actually is
free
reach, yes. Because the real world for them is free reach. They want to be able to just reach out to everybody. All the big tech people around him are social media people. That's a sure sign that we're pushing away from traditional media, of which you are, blindly following and focusing too much on him. By the way, you should give him maybe 2 minutes a day, but that's something to arrange between yourselves. But the free reach is what they want. They want to be able to access data, people, wherever they are, and do it through their social media, which convey only opinions and lies and disinformation. Okay, so they've stopped all the fact-checking possibilities in America, in the universities. They're pushing back. There's words that are forbidden. The word systemic is forbidden because systemic means that there is something linked to the structure and infrastructure, and it's all about the self-interest of the individual.
Forbidden where? Excuse me.
Forbidden by Trump's messages, long list of words that the natural science, the sciences foundations can't use, and etc. So this is official policy now at universities, and there's a list of words you can't use: inclusion, female, gender, of course, black, but also systemic, which for me is one of the crucial ones. But so there's. Those are the people who follow Trump. They're lied to. It's always a core, slight core of truth and then a big lie around it. So the Panama thing is typical. And there's two sides of it and he only shows one side. And then there's the others, the ones who did not vote for him. And please it or not to all the members here in the audience, are about half the country, and they're still there. They're protesting in Congress, they're dressing differently, because in the times of fear and in the times of bullying, the way you do it is the Queen of Elizabeth's way. You can't speak, so you wear it. And very close to the president, there's a woman who wears it. But the other ones exist, and their values are still there. And maybe they'll have a chance by midterm to be expressed. But they are, at the moment, extremely worried because the behavior of this government is extremely illiberal, dictatorial. We see elements here that are extremely preoccupying.
All right.
But there are two Americas, and both of them, I hope and I think, have their hearts in the good place and are actually all being hurt. There's not one person in America who doesn't know about another member that has lost his job in very bizarre ways without any compensation, et cetera, et cetera. This is extremely brutal. And eventually, this is going to flip back to...
There's going to be a boomerang effect.
Boomerang, yes.
Jeffrey Cabot-Service, a question a lot of French people ask, because in this country, when you disapprove, and if the country is divided, like Davina says, we like to demonstrate. We have big demonstrations, big protests. Where are the protests? I mean, we saw that Texas congressman get kicked out of the chamber, but we haven't seen the kind of mass protests we even saw at the beginning of Trump's first presidency. Where's the Democratic Party?
I'm not sure where the Democratic Party is, to be honest. And I'm also a registered Republican, so I'm not sure you should ask me. But it is noticeable that in 2017, really just immediately following upon Trump's inauguration, there were nationwide protests, the Resist movement, women wearing pussy hats, and so forth, and a lot of activism at the grassroots level. In 2021, the Democrats seem stunned, incapable of knowing how to respond, because it's true, the election was, in many ways, not so much, I think, an affirmation of Trump as a rejection of the Democratic model, which had all kinds of vulnerabilities. Democrats seemed unable to handle the issue of immigration, of public order, of prices, and actually, in many times, at many ways, seemed so insulated from the working class as to be an elite caste. So I think the Democrats are working to reinvent themselves. I think Alyssa Slotkin's response actually was a way forward by returning to the political center. And I found it fascinating that she invoked Ronald Reagan as a way of criticism. Yes, correct. Yes. And I found it fascinating that she invoked Ronald Reagan and his presidency and his leadership in the Cold War as a way of critiquing Donald Trump, who has almost nothing in common with Ronald Reagan.
Let me ask you, Reverend Butler, you heard Davina Frameggs talk about the social media factor in all of this. If you're a pastor in 2025 and you have a parish, what does social media do? Does it scramble your message when you talk about community? After all, social media is about every person's their own brand, the individual above all.
Again, I'm here as a religious leader, and I can tell you that the people who gather every Sunday in my parish are very, very scared. The numbers that are in the pews are growing. There are people who are crying every week. And I think that goes back to a lot of what the professor was saying. We're getting these messages of constant fear, which make us close down and cut off our communities, which is, of course, what authoritarian governments want us to do. We are not going to do that. The message of every major world religion is that we reach out to our neighbors, that we work together, that we care for those who are suffering, and we will keep doing that, even if it doesn't look like protesting. That is where our efforts need to be, because these are real people and they are suffering. And all the bluster that you heard is not the reality of what's going on. America calling itself a moral leader is a day gone past. And I would have to say that the choice of might over right is in complete contrast to any message from any major world religion, where we were always taught that care for our neighbor is our first and most important job.
Yeah, let's listen to Donald Trump. We talked about Panama earlier. Let's listen to Donald Trump talking in the same speech before that joint session of Congress about Greenland, which he's still coveting.
We need it really for international world security. And I think we're going to get it. One way or the other, we're going to get it. We will keep you safe. We will make you rich.
We will make you rich, Matt Klink. We will make you rich. Is that the message a U.S. president should be sending out?
Well, you conspicuously cut off the first part of that statement where he said that they should have it if they voted in a plebiscite to join the United States, that we would welcome them. So aside from that, look, that's a typical Donald Trump speech where he talks like this. I want to point out something, though, that a lot of this conversation has reminded me of the conversation I used to have with my children when they were younger. And I'm not calling you all children, you're highly educated professionals. But anytime the words of all or nothing or everything or never are used, we're not arguing about America's 100% withdrawal from the rest of the world. Case in point, we have more than 60,000 troops in Europe right now. We're arguing about the extent and the shape of that involvement. And it's the same argument that America is having domestically. We're not arguing about whether we should have government or not have government. We're arguing about the shape of government that U.S. wants to have. And right now, whether you like it or not, and this is where the Democrats have called Republicans deplorables, Obama said clinging to guns and religion, right now, Americans want less government, they want lower taxes, they want lower regulations, and they want food prices to come down. And I can tell you for a fact that right now they're cutting Donald Trump some slack, but in about 6 months, if the cost of eggs is still expensive, voters are fickle, and the voters that swung to him that are not in his base in November are going to swing back to the Democrats because Donald Trump didn't deliver the goods.
And just very briefly, Matt Klink, because we're running short on time, what's your definition of America's values?
America's values is we are a country that does right by the rest of the world, but we have lost track of the fact of doing right for Americans first. And I think that we will do both. It's just a question of finding the right balance. What has happened in the past and this internationalism, globalism perspective, America has suffered from it, and we need to put some more realism back into that.
Jeffrey Gabaservis, we're speaking on the eve of an emergency EU summit to talk about this defense architecture of this continent. Just your final word on this, because we're running short on time, about whether or not all this could change in the midterm elections, or whether this is a shift from which you can't go back?
I have one word.
Well, you know, there was a great deal of debate in the first Trump administration about whether to take Trump literally or seriously. And most of his supporters would say seriously, but not literally. So do I think, for example, that Trump is going to occupy Gaza and build a series of Trump hotels there? No, probably not. Will Trump actually invade Panama to take back the Panama Canal? No, he's often content with symbolic victories of the kind that we have already discussed here tonight. But, you know, Trump has said that he is free now to do what he wants. And it's true that there aren't sort of past generations of Republican officials standing around him saying, that might not be a good idea, Mr. President. That could cost us big time. So if Trump decides that he wants to pull America out of NATO, he will. And I think there's very little that any force can do to stop him from doing that. And I'm also just not sure, given his poor treatment of Zelensky, given all that he's said in the past several weeks, that anyone believes that if Lithuania, let's say, was invaded by Russia, that the United States would come to its defense. Mm. It almost feels like Article 5 of the NATO Charter is now a null and void. And I think there will be major consequences from this in terms of the way the world works and in terms of the amount that Europeans will have to spend not only on their own security, but on their own resources. But it'll have costs for the United States as well. And I think there'll be serious, serious costs. And I think even many of the people who voted for Trump will regret their vote, but they may have limited ability to do anything about it.
Jeffrey Gabaservis, I want to thank you so much for joining us from London. I want to thank Reverend Amy Butler for being with us from Honolulu. Matt Klink in Los Angeles. Davina Frau-Meggs, thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.